I'm sorry, I'm just getting emotional with you because this underscores the importance of what's happening and the dire need for our children's education.
Those positions are invaluable, and taking them away and hiring them later is unacceptable because they're not just positions. Those are people who are part of a really valuable community.
We knew we needed these learning specialists, so that's what we got, and now we're losing them.
We're in a crucial moment where we have to make sure our generations are properly educated so they can take the future reins.
I'm Jill Shaw, and you're listening to Last Night at School Committee. Ross Wilson and I are here to summarize for you what happened last night at the Boston Public Schools School Committee meeting. Ross, good morning.
Good morning, Jill. Prior to the school committee meeting last night, the committee hosted its third and final public budget hearing.
There were approximately 30 public comments last night, which fell into primarily two categories. One was advocacy for more funding for sports for the Boston Public Schools and its students. Here is a Boston resident on that topic.
We know that the White Stadium renovation project, which I am an IGA member on, is on hold. But making sure that we have enough, the budget reflects us having enough adequate spaces for our student athletes.
And this from City Councilor Brian Worrell.
I hope room for these ideas, especially the increased funding for sports, professional pathways, health and wellness days, and initiatives supporting Black and Latino boys can be found in this FY25 budget as we look forward to the final vote next week.
Right, Jill. Regarding City Council, Councilor Worrell basically says, well, we're hoping that we see something in the budget. But in fact, even if it's not in the budget, when it gets to the City Council, they can vote no until it is in the budget. So I'm hoping that the City Council members know that.
We entered into this budget season in the spirit of collaboration with BPS as part of an effort to advocate early in the budget process for the issues that are important to our constituents. This was not a desire to usurp the school committee's power, but rather an attempt to make sure all the branches of city government are working together to ensure our students are on the path to success.
Right, and they have the power to continue to move things in the direction that they want if they really are frustrated with
the components. Right, so it's not asking, like, we hope you're going to include this. They actually literally can hold them accountable for including it.
Almost demand it. So interestingly, regarding athletics, it sort of, Ross, brings up also the conversation that the city is having about White Stadium, particularly in the Boston Globe. Mayor Michelle Wu said that if the partnership with Boston Unity Soccer Partners falls apart, the $50 million that she had pledged towards redoing White Stadium would go to another Boston public school facility in need of repair. The mayor is quoted as saying that this is one facility within our larger BPS portfolio that has many, many needs. She said that there are 100 buildings that need significant work, and so it's hard to justify making an investment for partial improvement to a stadium above giving resources for the entire schools to be rebuilt. You know, she had pledged $50 million as part of this potential deal with Boston Unity Soccer Partners. You know, we just happened to Google last night while we were listening to school committee. It's about $4 or $5 million that you could put into White Stadium and get it a brand new 8-lane track and new turf in the field, which would be a massive improvement for students and student experience. So I hope that doesn't get lost in the conversation if this deal goes away. It seems like it shouldn't be all or nothing.
Well, Jill, I think you're totally right. The White Stadium conversation has been around for about 20 years. The stadium is in need of immediate repair.
Bathrooms, stands, etc. But, you know, at the end of the day, could at least improve the...
We absolutely need more facilities for our student athletes. We have issues at the Reggie Lewis Center, where our students in BPS don't get access to the Reggie Lewis in a timely manner. In fact, Jill, there was a city council hearing on the Reggie Lewis just recently where nobody from BPS showed up at the hearing.
Which it just seems strange given it's such a priority.
This must be a priority.
People in the city.
Jill, also, this, and just for listeners, the issue with White Stadium is that actually there's a lawsuit against the renovation of White Stadium, mostly, I think, around the plan was put out really quickly and not with a lot of community input. And I think there's concerns around privatization of a community asset. And really, I think everyone's interests are, how do we get our student athletes more experiences and better facilities, where literally our high school students don't have access to good athletic facilities. Jill, but really, I think what's really interesting here is $150 million does not build a new building.
Yeah,
it's not even close.
Of course.
New buildings are hundreds of millions of dollars now, and they take multiple years. So it's not as if that $50 million could go do some, $50 million, it could go build a new building. But also, Jill, the most important part that I took away from this was the mayor is the decision maker. This is not the school committee having this conversation publicly. The mayor is saying, I get to choose, essentially. She's saying, I will let you know where I'm going to put the long-term capital dollars.
When it comes to facilities.
Right. So this is not a school committee vote. This is not a city council vote, it appears, although I think it should be. But the mayor is basically saying, I'm deciding where we allocate money. So if you're a parent of a school that's in need of repair, the mayor is a decision maker, not the school committee. So, you know, really, this is, I want to be really clear about this. The mayor is making decisions about our facilities, and she allocates the funds herself. And so we should advocate to the mayor if you want something done in your building or in your community.
The public needs to target its conversation in that direction. The majority of the comments last night during the budget conversation that preceded the school committee meeting were about the district's move to inclusion classrooms in schools. Teachers and advocates seemed a bit confused about what the district is really looking for. And the district hadn't given them much guidance, basically kind of said, we're going to leave it in the hands of schools. And now schools are feeling restricted and that, you know, they're not getting approved for what they're putting forth, even though, you know, you would think they know their schools best. They complained that budget's being taken away. And then parents of those schools gave very emotional testimony, painting the district as having an unfair strategy for funding inclusion and not recognizing, in some cases, the already strong inclusion schools for what they are. First at the hearing, we hear from Ruby Reyes, who's the director of the Boston Education Justice Alliance.
This year's budget process has been unsettling due to the combination of loss of ESSER, the inclusion rollout that unfunded proposals without explanation, and a murky shift from weighted student funding to something else that hasn't been explained.
Then from a teacher who helped build her school's inclusion plan.
This year, we resubmitted our plan for our other grade levels. And this time, instead of getting the staff allocation that we asked for, we were granted 1.7 additional positions.
30 seconds.
1.7. This is a tiny fraction of what is needed to successfully meet the needs of our students in the remaining grades. Our educators feel like we were duped, like we were led out into the deepest part of the ocean in a rowboat with one oar, and now we're being told you're not getting the other oar. If the district truly wants to meet the needs of all diverse students, it's essential that you listen to the experiences of your school staff and provide us with sufficient teachers, paraprofessionals.
Thank you very much, Ms. Banks.
And this from another teacher who worked on the inclusion planning team for her school.
The required inclusion planning process took 13 people, 10 hours, and we received just 3 sentences in response, which essentially said, you are a model for inclusion in the district, therefore you get no additional resources.
We then hear from a parent who asks, what is the inclusion plan that is being funded?
The district is in the process of implementing an inclusion plan, but they're not taking into consideration those students that have special needs. So it is very difficult for me to understand what is the inclusion model that they are promoting.
And then, Jill, we heard a number of impassioned pleas from parents at multiple schools to really advocate for keeping some of the support roles that are in place for kids on IEPs, rather than cutting positions today with the promise of potentially reinstating them at some other time in the future.
My son loved going to school. He was doing really well, and those positions are invaluable. And taking them away and hiring them later is unacceptable because they're not just positions. Those are people who are part of a really valuable community, and they make a huge difference, not only for the kids with IEPs, but for all the kids. And they're just really important and we need them. So thank you for the time.
So in the course of about an hour and a half, there were over a dozen different schools represented in the plea to the district to help schools and parents please understand BPS's strategy for inclusion schools, including how ELL works in this model and what the expectations are for staffing and outcomes. The evening then moved along to the school committee meeting where the superintendent provided her report.
And first, Jill, in the superintendent's report, we heard from Superintendent Skipper about a recent announcement. And now this is a little bit of a theme where we hear the superintendent reporting on media announcements that have happened outside of the school committee. But the first announcement was a $21 million grant from the federal government over 3 years for the support of mental health services in 21 BPS schools that will impact about 5,000 students. Here's the report as covered by WBZ News.
Well, tonight, Boston is investing millions to support the mental health of kids and their families.
Yeah, the Public Health Commission announced $21 million for mental and behavioral health programs in Boston public schools.
for our young people to know that they can access that not by going downtown far away from where they might live, but right here in their school buildings.
The money comes from federal grants and programs. A recent health department report found a significant increase in sadness, hopelessness, and anxiety among Boston's youth, especially young people of color. Mayor Wu says some of this money will fund the hiring of more behavioral specialists for Boston Public Schools.
This announcement seemed contrary to what some mental health professionals are understanding as a cut to mental health care for BPS students, including a move away from bilingual mental health care.
7 years at the Charles Sumner Elementary School. School psychologists are facing cuts, possible cuts in positions due to the loss of their funds. Having school psychologists who speak the languages of our families is a strength and something that is in danger of disappearing as we face a loss of positions. I was asked to translate 3 times yesterday at my school. We are asked to do more without any kind of differential. BPS can no longer rely on the goodwill of my colleagues to ensure families and students get what they need. BPS needs to fairly compensate bilingual school psychologists for our skill set and not encourage us to stop being bilingual, as that does not serve our students and families.
So it seems like there's definitely something to sort out there, or at least explain better to the staff who are serving the mental health needs of BPS students.
Jill, I agree on this one. And this always boils down to more details, like what's actually happening. What are the details of these press announcements and understanding how that impacts our students?
It makes total sense to spend money in our town to go after and try to heal this mental health issue and crisis. But you can't do it. That cannot just be an announcement. I mean, this is a real crisis across the country.
Plan.
And so it has to be a real plan. Like, those dollars need to be well spent. That $21 million over a couple of years probably doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of the needs of the kids in the city.
In fact, Jill, what we should be having is a conversation at the school committee level, looking at the youth risk survey, looking at the climate surveys that are collected by BPS.
Yeah.
Those data should be made public. There should be public conversation about what do we do about these data, because they are incredibly concerning data.
We've read them and they're tough.
Jill, there were several good news items that the superintendent reported in last night's meeting. First, the new Carter School in the South End is going to open in the fall of 25. This took about 10 years, right? This is important to remember how long this process has been happening. This
right.
is, I think, over 3 mayors or 4 mayors this has been happening about the Carter School. It will open in fall of 25. It's going to be a spectacular facility, and the kids there will benefit from it greatly.
It's so good.
Also, we got game, Jill. We got 3 teams in Boston Public Schools who won their divisions. So the basketball team at Charlestown High School, the New Mission basketball team also won their division, and BLS varsity hockey team. They're all state champions in their divisions, which is just amazing. And this has been a long time coming to see BPS students being state champions. And geez, I think if we had more facilities, our students are so incredibly talented. We need more athletic facilities for our students to practice in. And I think we'd have a lot more state champions. All of our students are incredible. And it's an awesome job for those teams.
And don't forget, this and all of the extracurriculars that we offer to kids in the city are a mental health play, right?
Sure.
Like, this is the kind of stuff that drives dopamine in a very healthy way. We have to make sure that we provide enough of it.
It also helps with chronic absenteeism.
Sure
when,
does.
When you're going to
sure
win the
does.
State championship, you're coming to school every day. That's for sure.
That's right.
Jill, we also heard from student member Diego Meta, who is going to Northeastern next year on a full scholarship.
Yay,
it's just
Diego.
Just a reminder, Jill, that so many of our students achieve amazing things and get to go to our amazing universities in Boston. And a number of our students go for full rides.
It's incredible.
It's awesome.
So good. The evening then moved along into public comment, and longtime advocate John Mudd opened public comment with this.
We are told the school committee will approve a general fund budget showing an increase of over 220 staff positions, while at the same time the committee is given documentation that in fact when all funds are accounted for, including the end of ESSER, the district will suffer a loss of 339 positions.
He then went on to say,
many of these changes are a result of the district's inclusionary education plan. This plan reflects a major transformation in education policy. The school committee has the responsibility to establish education policy, yet it did not give prior approval to this new policy before it was sent to the state. The evidence says it is the wrong policy for English learners. You can still stop its implementation for English learners.
Public comment questioning BPS's plan and strategy for moving to full inclusion continued from what we heard earlier in the budget meeting to the school committee meeting. We heard this from a parent at the Manning School, which is a full inclusion school and has been for close to a decade.
Manning has long been a model of inclusion for students with social and emotional needs, but have only learned in the last few weeks that our school will lose teachers because our very successful model is not in alignment with the BPS vision of what inclusion should look like. Instead of coming to our amazing teaching, paraprofessional, and special education team and asking them how inclusion can be successfully implemented, we're being told that BPS has a better model. The data presented to say we're not serving all our students seems very flawed. We've not been given data to prove that this new model is an improvement, and this new model will affect all students in all the grades.
She goes on to talk about how this will directly impact the performance of the school and negatively affect its students.
We're not rolling out new teaching to one grade or to two. We are doing this to our entire school, affecting all eight grades in every single classroom and every single student. And as caregivers, we've tried to engage PPS and our school leadership for weeks. We've met a lot of resistance to our questions and concerns. We've only just received answers to written questions we submitted to our principal and Dr. Luna 4 weeks ago, and we just received them yesterday. I'm disappointed that huge changes to our model have been made without sufficient community involvement in a very successful school and a model for inclusion. And I'm very, very concerned that we're losing talented teachers.
So Jill, the Manning School has been a great example of a full inclusionary school for quite a few years now. They actually started with including students with emotional impairment. And a little history on this. Students with emotional impairment used to be completely separated from their peers. They were actually in the basement of the Manning School and in like the worst classrooms. And there was a school leader who came in and said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. Actually, we're going to have everybody be inclusive. We're going to have a flexible staffing model. And that's what they created at the Manning over a number of years. It has always been a shining example of inclusionary practices. It's been a leader on the group of schools that have been planning for inclusionary work for years in Boston.
Right.
Also, I should say that Vice Chair Michael O'Neill is also a graduate of the Manning School. Mm-hmm. And it's a really important school in our city. The strange part of this, Jill, is the irony that as we're moving to more inclusionary practices for all schools, the district seems to be dismantling the inclusion program at the Manning School. And the change that the Manning School community is feeling led to several comments from community members last night that are referred to as feeling duped by the district when it comes to trying to plan for inclusion.
And the plan to reduce the model to shared learning specialists across grades is a marked reduction in services. Moreover, the caregiver community has been left out of any conversation about these changes. And in fact, from what I can tell, essentially duped by BPS to participate in IPT efforts that were ultimately an exercise in futility. It's beyond disappointing that BPS would pretend to value community and teacher input in this way, only to push forward a top-down plan.
Ruby Reyes testified at the school committee meeting last night as well. She used what has happened with the O'Brien School over the past year as an example of the continuous lack of strategy and rigorous process for facilities planning, and accused the city of making a less than unproductive show of moving the O'Brien, which ended in no strategy and no budget to make improvements to one of the district's only high-performing high schools.
The O'Brien School community fought to keep their school from moving to West Roxbury. It was a terrible proposal and process. In retaliation, the money set aside for their desperately needed renovations have suddenly disappeared because they demanded an authentic process and developed their own student, parent, and educator solutions.
And she ends by saying,
where is the list of completed school openings and building renovations? When will transparency be provided for community members and those most impacted? The answer should be now.
The committee then moved to a series of votes. The first vote was a unanimous approval of Ms. Parvex to the role of executive secretary for the school committee. There was then a vote on grants, which was approved unanimously, and Dr. Alkins mentioned yet again that he would like to see improvement in the way school committee members receive information about grants and performance of the programs they are funding.
The second vote was on the MSBA proposal for the BCLA McCormick. This is a vote to approve the submission of a statement of interest in building a new high school for the BCLA McCormick community. When asked if this was a priority for the district, the superintendent responded.
This was strategically picked, one, because a lot of the work, you know, had already been talked about with the community. The UMass partnership makes it really unique in a lot of ways for an opportunity. And so I would say, yes, this is a priority project for us.
And Ms. Stanislaus, Chief of Capital Planning, adds,
where the BCLA McCormick is a bit different is that the merger for the BCLA McCormick community happened years ago, and there were a lot of promises to that school community of like renovations and expansions of sort of like expanding the number of students on that campus.
And Jill, I think this obviously goes to a larger point around a master facility plan.
Yeah.
Like, is in 10 years, do we need another high school?
Right.
And what actually, by the way, what about Madison Park? What about the O'Brien School? Right. What about, I think we've been hearing about the Jackson Mann, and where, you know, the Jackson Mann needs a new school, and the new Mel King Academies, which these buildings, Jill, are like falling down.
We're right back to, we need a master plan.
I'm sorry. We won't get into it again.
Right. We need a master plan. Right. There doesn't seem to be a master plan. This just seems to be, like, we're going to just keep making announcements and holding bright, shiny objects in front of people and hoping that something works. But man, you know, you're right. Like, at some point, we do think about what new buildings are we going to build? Yeah. Where are we going to consolidate? When are we going to start thinking about the best things to do for our students?
In any case, Jill, the school committee unanimously voted to approve the submission of the statement of interest for BCLA McCormick. And this just enters it into a process and will be a multi-year process. We'll see how it goes.
That's right. The third vote was on the Student Opportunity Act, which is required to be submitted to the state by April 1st.
Right. And Mr. Cadet Hernandez mentions that he will vote yes because it's against the clock and there's pressure to vote yes. And he does say he's remained concerned about the district's literacy curriculum. We talked about the data that we saw at the last meeting, which is incredibly concerning.
Right.
And yet we're sort of putting more resources into the same approach.
I remain incredibly concerned that we are using curriculum that has not been validated by external sources, particularly in our earliest grades. And I hear, and I have submitted questions, and I don't know if those make their way sort of to the general public, but I have submitted questions about that process. But I do just think it's really important for us to be circling back as a committee. Like, we know phonics is the most important. I bet you it's lovely curriculum, but in this moment with the literacy outcomes that we have within our system, and there being existing curriculum that is approved and validated, I just think it's really important for us to keep our eye on this conversation and to do whatever it takes to get external validation, or decide if, like, the thing we've created can't be validated, then maybe we shouldn't use it.
And the Student Opportunity Act passed with 5 members voting in favor and 1 abstaining vote from Mr. Tran.
I will abstain from this vote, given my serious concern regarding inclusion practices that does not really address fully on plans for students with disability, as well as bilingual students, students with multilingual issues.
Lastly, we heard the final public discussion with questions from school committee about the fiscal year 25 budget. So, Ross, we're almost down to the end of this. The vote will happen at the next school committee meeting, which is next week.
That's right. And, you know, we didn't see much of a change, Jill, from what was recommended by the superintendent in the first round and where we are today. But we do see a budget that seems to be structurally really unsound. And quite frankly, it's bloated. And as this district moves away from this wage student funding to a new approach, we're seeing a lot of inefficiencies in the budget process.
The superintendent said this about that fact.
We must continue to operate some of the ways that we're serving our students while we build a new infrastructure, essentially creating parallel systems that both cost money.
So it's interesting, Ross, right? And I think we heard something as the evening continued that we can talk about a little bit more, but basically soft landings and this need for funding parallel programming seem to be providing what effectively is a soft landing for the superintendent and staff while they move the city away from what actually was not weighted student funding, but weighted student funding plus, right, to a model that is more logical and more rigorous. So it seems that the district understands that the current funding process is more convoluted than is actually apparent to the community. And Mr. O'Neill sort of gets into a definition of what's wrong with the current model of weighted student funding plus.
When we dug in, it was usually, you know, because of favoritism or teachers who knew, principals who knew how to work the system and so on and so forth. And it really exposed inequities in our system. That's where soft landings first came from, to kind of help the schools that were going to be cutting budgets get used to it, so to speak. And it's become a crutch over the years. I heard Mr. Bloom say it will still be a formula. And that's important to know, because I want to make sure, Superintendent, how you ensure that we don't creep back into a system that favoritism could make a difference, so to speak. I want to make sure we're equitable to our schools.
An acting CFO, David Bloom, adds to the conversation about moving away from weighted student funding.
And I think what we found in weighted student funding is we were continually over the years needing to build rules that weren't weighted student funding to ensure equity. So we had to allocate social workers separately. We had to allocate family liaisons separately. And eventually what we sort of realized is, you know, every year what we're learning from the committee, from the public, from others, from the feedback is just adjusting the weights isn't working. Mr. O'Neill, I remember in our initial, so our first few budgets with you and with Chair Robinson, we would talk about changing the weights, and that would be the adjustments we would make. We would add the homelessness weight, for example. We had talked about adjusting the weight for high school, and then we walked that back after some pressure, right? What we really found was adjusting the weights wasn't the answer to the problems we were having, right? It's needing a different approach.
So Jill, it's interesting. Weighted student funding has been around for quite a number of years.
Wait, weighted student funding is an actual calculation.
It is a calculation. It is actually a calculation by the student, right? So the money follows the student, and there's weights based on student need. And so if you have students with more needs at your school, you have more money.
But what we heard last night is that, yes, that's been the underlying mechanism for funding. But there's all of this fluffy stuff that's been happening around the edges, which has resulted in most schools receiving soft landings, right?
Right. I have a point of view here on weighted student funding.
Yeah, go.
And essentially, weighted student funding was a transparent process. Mm-hmm. It allowed for the public and everybody to know how budgets were built and which schools were viable or not viable and how resources were being spent. The challenge with weighted student funding is it leads you to decision making, right? So for example, if you don't have enough students in your school, you can't fund programs, and ultimately that school—
Something has to be done with that school
you have to make
and
a
that
decision.
Community, yes.
And the BPS over the years has never made hard decisions.
And that's what we mean when we're saying they moved to weighted student funding plus, which is all of this fluffy stuff that happened around the edges.
And plus is called soft landings.
Right.
And we started soft landings as just a transition period. When we moved from the old budgeting process to weighted student funding, we did soft landings for a couple of, we're like, oh, just do it for a couple of years to protect any major transitions. They never stopped. And now we have almost every school receiving a soft landing.
You know, here's the thing, though. I give credit to the superintendent and her team for recognizing this. I mean, and I think this is why she's talking about this parallel buffer that she's put in, where she's got to fund more things than she wants to for a year while they come up with a new algorithm, which is rigorous and logical and one that can't really be played with.
This is where you and I disagree. You're very optimistic, Jill, that there's a rigorous and logical budgetary process.
I think they understand the need for one.
Sure, Jill, but I would say until you begin to make decisions,
That's going to come down to leadership, right?
It does, but for years we've pushed these decisions forevermore in the future.
Sure, sure.
And I would argue that moving away from weighted student funding is simply the desire not to make decisions.
But they made the point last night that weighted student funding will be in the new algorithm. And
you are so trusting.
I am just saying, I do believe that everyone understands the need for a rigorous calculation. Adhering to that calculation is always the problem, right? That's what requires great leadership.
And you have to make decisions.
That's right. So, you know, this is either, you know, one more year of super fluffy stuff that's really hard to understand when it comes to funding our schools, which is going to tee us up for something that's going to be rolled out that is algorithmic and easy to understand and everyone can, you know, manage to it. Or you're right. the wool has been pulled over my eyes. And,
well, Jill,
and either way, we're headed into
that's
a
right.
decade where it's not going to be as easy as the past decade because the city is not going to be flush with cash.
We've been saying for a number of years now, prepare for the future, prepare for the future. And we're at the future now. And Michael right. O'Neill really sums this up, Jill, about what we'll be facing in the future.
I know a suggestion has been made, and I wholeheartedly endorse it, that we need to be doing some multi-year planning. Even if, you know, the farther out, if we do 5 years, for example, we're really guessing what's going to be happening years 2, 3, and 4. But there are changes coming to the tax base in this city with the reliance on commercial property and so many requests for abatements now. More will probably end up shipping. And the mayor has been talking about this publicly, right? So more will probably end up shifting to the residential tax base. But we need to be thinking about the impact and the city's ability to fund us and what's going to happen with the district.
And that's what happened last night at the Boston Public Schools School Committee meeting.
We appreciate hearing from so many of you. If you have further thoughts and questions about how BPS is serving your student, please send us an email at podcast@shahfoundation.org. That's shahfoundation.org.
Thank you for listening to Last Night School Committee. We hope that you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you did, please rate, review, like, and share it with your fellow friends, parents, and residents of Boston. We all have a stake in the future success of Boston students. Have a great day.